Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I guess I'm going to definitely put this in one of my top 10 interviews of celebrity athletes. And it's an absolute honor to have this player on, former NFL player, Hall of Famer, Heisman Trophy winner, Green Bay Packer legend, NFL legend, Paul Hornung. Paul, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Very good. Very good. How are you doing up there?
I'm doing great because we're getting countdown to Christmas. I'm starting to finally feel better. It's rough. When the flu hits you, you know, that's how it is for sure. So, Paul, did you always think in your life that you were going to be this type of unbelievable NFL player growing up?
No, not really. You know, I don't think anybody does when they're young. They start thinking about it when you get to high school and college, that you might have an opportunity to go on from where you are. So, you know, I never did think of professionally when I was in high school. You know, I was always might have got that idea when I got to Notre Dame. That's about it.
Well, yeah, Notre Dame, once you have success in Notre Dame, especially at that time, Paul, you knew that you're going to have a special career, right?
Yeah, that was special. And, you know, back then, you know, we had a horrible season my senior year. I had a pretty good year my sophomore and junior years. But my senior year, we lost 8 football games. So when I won the Heisman Trophy on a losing team that lost 8 games, that was probably a terrific surprise.
Yeah, definitely. It's because it was just a sad year, right? You hate losing, I'm sure.
Pardon me?
You hate losing, right, Paul?
Well, absolutely. You don't ever want to go out there, you know, and start thinking about you're going to lose a ball game or anything. We were always very confident game after game after game, but we were experiencing a very tough schedule with not too many experienced football players. And when you do that at a place like Notre Dame, you're going to be in trouble.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you were glad that you had an opportunity to get to win. Did you end up winning? And you ended up winning in Notre Dame after that, right?
Well, no. My senior year, we were 2-8.
Oh, 2-8. So, oh, geez. Okay. So,
yeah. So that was my last. Well, sure. My sophomore and junior years, we were winners. And, that was an unexpected 2-8 season, you know. And almost any time if Notre Dame is 2-8, that's going to be a surprise to everybody.
Just the ball didn't go the right way for you, right, that year.
Right.
And that happens so much in football. Couple turnovers, couple situations. You guys probably scheduled some really tough teams that year for sure.
That's correct.
What was your fondest memory, would you say, at Notre Dame?
That's my fondest memory is winning the Heisman Trophy, of course. My senior year, that was, you know, quite a surprise even for me. And, you know, I was voted quite highly in the Heisman my junior year. So, actually, I was kind of one of the favorites going into my senior year. But we had great football players that I was going against. Jim Brown was a senior at Syracuse. John Arnett was a senior at USC. John Brody was a senior quarterback at Stanford. And those 3 or 4 football players, you know, were publicized and were in contention for the Heisman Trophy, all of them.
And your season stood out. And that just must have been amazing when you talk about the competition you had, for sure, for the Heisman. Definitely.
Well, I had a good year individually as far as that was concerned, the statistics and the whole thing. But I did a lot of things on the football field, and I think that helped me. Playing both offense and defense and leading the team in interceptions and tackles and those kind of things. You know, people pick up on versatility, I think. And they started to about in that time in the late 50s where they started looking at a college football player and if he had enough ability to do a lot of things, you know, his name came to the front in a lot of things, and I was lucky enough to be in that position.
Definitely. So, Paul, growing up, if we could go back a bit from growing up, especially, you didn't know till Notre Dame that, you know, this is going to, you're going to be a great football player. But you must have loved the game. Was that the game that you played as your favorite sport growing up?
Sure, yeah. I played all three sports in high school, baseball, football, and basketball. And I wanted to go to Kentucky and also play basketball. And Bear Bryant, who was the coach of Kentucky in those days, he had it arranged with Adolph Rupp that I could go out for the basketball team. Well, that was very important for me in those days. So I kind of, I think all of my friends knew I wanted to go to Kentucky and play both sports. I decided to go to Notre Dame because my mom wanted me to go to Notre Dame. That was the main reason. And I did play a year at Notre Dame, play basketball. My junior year, I played basketball for the University of Notre Dame, and I enjoyed it. And but Terry Brennan, the coach, the next year, he didn't want me to play basketball, and he asked me not to, and I didn't.
Because they knew you were going to be a special player, and they didn't want to see you get injured in basketball, and then they don't have me for football.
Well, I don't think it's too much a problem about injury. The problem was they wanted to, didn't want my grades to possibly slip where I would become eligible. You know, it's pretty tough up there scholastically, and, you know, I was a good student. I never had any problems with failings, but they wanted me to keep my grades high where I would be eligible. So I agreed with them. I agreed with Coach Brennan, and but I didn't get to play my senior year, and I really wanted to play basketball. So I enjoyed it, though. I had a great career at Notre Dame. I'll always remember it.
Definitely. When you talked about academics and your mom wanting to go to Notre Dame, was academics important when you're playing the three sports? And growing up and stuff to hit the books?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. They're very tough up there as far as grades are concerned. And they still are to this day. And if you're an athlete at the University of Notre Dame and you're playing football especially, you got to keep up with your fellow students. And you got to stay on the passing side of grades so you still become eligible the next year. So they watch it quite closely.
Went go on to Green Bay and get to play for the legendary coach Vince Lombardi. Tell me what you learned from Vince. Definitely playing.
Well, he was the best. He was the best thing that ever happened to me as far as pro football is concerned. You know, he brought us all around and got us thinking in the same vein that we could win and we had the abilities to win. And he got us thinking, you know, we got to a level where we didn't think we could lose. And so playing for him was really the highlight of my football career in my lifetime, having the opportunity to play for Coach Lombardi. It was special, and, I always have to thank him for the success that I had.
And then being inducted in the Hall of Fame and being one of the successful Packer teams, especially with the first Super Bowls and stuff, that's just got to be amazing to look at your whole career for sure.
Well, it was fine.
Definitely. You know what's interesting, Paul? Your book, again, Paul Horning's Scrapbook, definitely brings a lot of personal stories and memories from the Golden Boy. What do you think was your favorite memory, would you say?
Well, I just think getting that book together, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The scrapbook has come out. It's been a pretty popular item up, especially up in Wisconsin. I've been up there for a couple of the games, and we sold out almost everywhere we'd arrive and promoting the book, the Paul Horning scrapbook. So I got next weekend, I'm going back up for the Detroit game. We got some appearances in Milwaukee and two or three in Green Bay. So it's going to keep me busy, but I enjoy it.
Well, that's great. So where's the best place that we can purchase it at triumphbooks.com?
At any bookstore, they'll have them.
Okay, well, Paul, best of luck, and have a great holiday, and good talking to you, man.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And the anniversary show, exciting week of unbelievable guests. Was hoping to do a lot of them last week, and life got in the way. But I'm excited to welcome the program, especially a huge college basketball fan that I am. Art Chansky, author of The Blue Divide, Duke, North Carolina, and the Battle on Tobacco Road. Art, thanks for calling, and how are you?
You're welcome, and it's nice to talk to you, except what have you been doing, partying too hard with your voice?
Not at all. It's I have five kids of my own, and we had the flu bug, and I'm just surviving, and that's all it is. But the good news about radio is I won't sound as horrible as you're hearing me on the other end of the phone, and you'll be doing the talking because you're the expert. I'm excited to ask a bunch of questions, but being asked to talk about this book for sure, to write this book, to talk about the great rivalry of Duke and North Carolina must have been an honor to be asked to do this.
Yeah, you know, the Duke-Carolina rivalry is unique for many reasons. I mean, there's Alabama, Auburn, there's Michigan, Ohio State, there's even UCLA and USC. You know, none of those are 8 miles away from each other, and none of those have been featured quality top 10 basketball for each program for most of the last 50 years. So, and the rivalry is also opposites. Carolina is a state university with a large student body, mostly in-state. Duke is a private school with a small student body, mostly out-of-state. Both have the elite students of their class, and there's a real mutual respect. I mean, they want to beat each other's brains out when they play, but they both agree that they all love the rivalry when both teams are great. And the rivalry has created so many stories that both schools follow, whether the stories involve both schools, it doesn't really matter. For example, we have one chapter about what really happened with Mike Krzyzewski in 1995 when he went out for most of the season with a back injury. You know, there were a lot of rumors about what was going on. When Johnny Moore, my counterpart, you know, tells that story, and that was of great interest to Carolina, just like what's going on at UNC right now with some of the academic stuff is of great interest at Duke. So we collaborated. It's not a point counterpoint in any way. We start off with the chapter about the snow game at Carolina last year that got snowed out, and Duke was coming all the time, and then when they found out that they might have to play in front of 22,000 students, they decided not to come. They said they said the bus couldn't get to Durham, but, you know, we kind of joked about that a little bit, but told the whole story of that and many stories to go back to the history of it. And then recently, too, you know, we tell a story about what really happened to Roy Williams and why he turned the job down in 2000. And then it went to Matt Doherty, which was a disaster. Fortunately, Roy decided not to stay in Kansas and came back the second time. So it's stories that people who follow the rivalry, and, you know, every game since 1986 has been on national TV. So it's really a national rivalry. It used to be just kind of a Tobacco Road backyard thing. But it started way back in 1960 when Art Haman, the best player in the country, committed to Carolina. And then his stepfather got into a fight with Frank McGuire, who was the coach at Carolina at the time. He changed his mind and he went to Duke, of all places. And so that became a much bigger rivalry than football, which had been the prime rivalry between Duke and Carolina. So we have all kinds of things there. I mean, people who appreciate the history of it will love it. People who, you know, who think Duke basketball started with Coach K in the 1980s, you know, there's plenty of stuff in it for them, too. And it's a lot of fun to write, to tell new stories that people haven't heard, and also drill down deeper and tell the backstories to things that people have heard about, because there's a lot more detail on what really happened.
Well, think about the rivalry and the type of players that played against each other that went on to the NBA as superstars and legends. Some of those games, how many NBA players were on the court at the same time? It's got to be amazing.
Were.
Yeah,
it really was. And, you know, especially in the years when players didn't go early, you know, Duke went 18 years before they had a player leave early. Now they got like a one and done every year, and, you know, people wonder what happened. I think Coach K just made the adjustment that he said, I still want the best players, and the best players are not going to stay. So I'm going to take them. Even if they're one and done, I'll get another one, like Jabari Parker last year and Jahlil Okafor this year. Well, Roy is, you know, has had one and dones, Marvin Williams and Brandon Wright, but he's taken more the traditional Dean Smith approach, and that is building a foundation of a program and then having your superstars come in and, you know, and really take it to another level. So that's a contrast that's going on right now. And we'll see about the one and dones who have great talent but no college experience when they go up against the Carolina team that has a little more experience and, you know, maybe not as much talent. So we'll see when that matchup occurs.
Well, Carolina had the opportunity last year to really the young players get experience, and that's key. And now Duke doesn't have the experience as much as North Carolina, so it'll be quite interesting to see what happens. Your take on better coach right now, Krzyzewski or Roy Williams?
Well, you have to say it's Mike Krzyzewski because of what he's done, his body of work over a long period of time. You know, he's going to have 1,000 career wins within the next couple of weeks, I think, or maybe the next month. And that's a number that'll never be surpassed or even caught, because coaches, number one, they don't start as a head coach as early as Krzyzewski did. He was in his mid-20s when he started at Army. Schools want to go, when they hire a coach, now they want to go with someone who has head coaching experience. And then the other thing, too, is that coaches don't stay in the game as long as Mike has. He's in his 34th year at Duke, and he coached 6 years at Army. So he's approaching 40 years coaching basketball, and coaches just don't stay that long anymore. And there are more games now, but it's a matter of longevity more than anything else. So Roy Williams is a great coach. He's also a Hall of Famer, and he has more national championships. He has two national championships in the last 10 years, where Mike really only has one. So, you know, he's won a lot of games. He's had a lot of turmoil in the program over the last few years. He just lost his best friend last week from cancer, and that really took a personal bearing on him. He's had some other personal issues that have come up. So Roy's struggling a little bit. His team hasn't quite gelled yet. But it's a long season, and when those two schools play each other, the coaches as well as the players are at the top of the games.
Do you think conference realignment's going to hurt Duke and North Carolina down the line with all the talent that's in the ACC now, winning-wise?
I didn't get all of the question, but I think you asked about who's favored in the ACC.
No. Conference realignment with how ACC has Pitt now, they have Syracuse, they have Louisville.
Right.
You have a lot more talent. You need to have teams that are not that good to beat at times. Do you think that's going to hurt?
That's a great point. You know, right now, three ACC teams are in the top 10. That's Duke. Obviously, that's Louisville and Virginia. And then you've got three, Miami, Carolina, and Notre Dame, that are in the next 10. So it's really the best, by far the best conference in college basketball right now. But there are teams that are struggling, you know, Wake Forest, Clemson, teams like that. And those are the games that you have to win in order to get well over 500, which is sort of the barometer of whether you make the NCAA tournament or not. You have to have a 500 record. They play an 18-game schedule. So you have to go 9-9. And in order to do that, you've got to beat the teams you expected to beat.
I liked it more when it was regionalized because the powerhouses could stay the powerhouses. Every year it's going to change because of recruiting. I know Duke and North Carolina always be the teams, but I think North Carolina will be hurt more by conference realignment than Duke. Duke's tradition, the opportunity for a student athlete to go to Duke is just amazing. I think that's what's going to always keep Duke possibly a stronger powerhouse than North Carolina later on. I think based on, you talk about schools that are just like North Carolina, Syracuse, you look at Louisville, unbelievable coaches that now Roy Williams has to compete with for recruiting.
Yeah, no question. I mean, when you have four Hall of Fame coaches in the same league and in teams that traditional powers. Syracuse will struggle a little bit this year because they lost so many guys last year and they didn't refill right away. But the idea that this every night you have the chance to play a team that's going to be looking at the bullseye on the chest of Duke and Carolina, certainly all the new teams in the ACC, all they want to do is beat Duke and Carolina because they're the benchmark schools of the ACC. And that's what's created this rivalry so much and created the stories. Boeheim got into it last year when he objected to a call so strenuously against Duke
end of the game. Yeah.
But he got those two technicals and got thrown out of the game. And after the game, he said, "I just wanted everybody to know that the old man can still move a little bit," So, yeah, those are moments you capture, and you want to remember those, and then you want to get into the rivalry. There have been years when each program was down. When Mike was out in 95 and they had a poor team in 96, Carolina, developed, different rivalries in the league. When Carolina was down during the Daugherty years, that really elevated the Duke-Maryland rivalry. As you remember those games between Gary Williams and Duke. Yeah, that created. But it always comes back to Duke and Carolina. I mean, they have more Final Four appearances than any other conference, all schools combined, just these two schools. And, they have, two of the five top winning programs in history, the winningest coach in history, the coach who got the 300 and 500 wins faster than anybody, that's Roy Williams. And then, as you mentioned, the bevy of great players from Art Haman all the way through Shaheel Okafor and Tyler Hansbrough and the great ones that have played in the league. And, it's legendary. We have a chapter in there about Hansbrough have never lost at Cameron Indoor Stadium, so all the fans refer to it now as Hansbrough Indoor Stadium.
Wow.
Imagine going into Cameron four straight years and winning. That's really, that I think as a leading rebounder, leading scorer, All-American, ACC Player of the Year, all those things that Hansbrough accomplished, I bet you he would tell you that winning four straight in Cameron is the biggest thrill that he's had in college.
Quite interesting. So let's look at this, the big picture of favorite teams, first of all, during the rivalry. Duke, what was your favorite all-time team in Duke, and then North Carolina from the book, you think?
Well, Duke's had great teams all the way through, and it's hard for me. I'm a Carolina guy, and that's why we wrote this book. It's a collaboration between me and Johnny Moore, who's a lifetime Duke guy. And so it's hard for me to say that.
Oh, you can't say anybody really, Duke. You just hate them, just like I hate Penn State. So I understand completely. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I like that. It seems obviously the 92 team where Leighton hit the shot against Kentucky to help go back-to-back. It was one of the best college teams ever assembled. Carolina beat them for one of their only losses that year. That was tremendous. I remember the Banks, Chiminski, Spinnaker teams of the late 70s under Bill Foster. Those teams were tremendous and had great rivalry games with Carolina and kept the rivalry from going about 12 years with Duke being down. I mean, Bill Foster really saved the rivalry as much as anybody because before he got top 10 teams, Duke was down for a while, and then Krzyzewski was down in his first few years. So Foster's three top 10 teams at the end of the 70s were really important to maintain the rivalry. Carolina, the 1977 team that was all banged up and injured and made it all the way to the Final Four before the Four Corners backfired on Dean Smith and they lost to Al McGuire and Marquette. That was one of my favorite teams. The 1993 team, which personified Dean Smith as a coach because the sum of the parts were better than any of the individual parts. None of those players, Lynch, Montross, Brian Reese, Derek Phelps, Donald Williams, none of those players became household names in the NBA. Some of them played in the NBA a little bit, but it was a classic Dean Smith coaching job because the sum of the parts were better than the individual parts. And they beat the Fab Five for the national championship in 93, just as Duke had beaten the Fab Five for the championship in 1992.
Interesting. And we all remember the Chris Webber infamous timeout, for sure.
Yeah. And everybody blames Weber, but people don't remember that Carolina was ahead in that game. So even if they didn't call a timeout, they would have had to score a basket. And it was great defense by Derek Phelps and George Lynch to trap them in the corner and cause them to call that timeout. So the credit has to be shared. I mean, it was a stupid move by Weber, not knowing how many timeouts were left, but Carolina made him panic, and that had a lot to do with it.
The team of Jordan and Worthy that year, again, that was another infamous Brown did with Georgetown in the national championship game.
Exactly right. And same, it's, you know, if he hadn't gotten confused by the defense that Carolina's playing and Freddie Brown and thrown it away, they still would have had to gone down and make the basket because the Tar Heels were ahead by 1 point. So it's not like if Weber hadn't called a timeout and if Brown hadn't thrown the ball away, Georgetown and Michigan would have won those two games. You can't say that because they were behind in both of those games at that time.
Exactly. And so you see both programs, the rivalry, but let's go into the people, the fans. How does it like break up families or families get angry at each other when this game comes up? Tell us some stories of that. Did you mention that in the book at all?
Yeah, the families, with the schools being 8 miles apart and living and basically in the same community, you have lots of blended families. There are lots of bumper stickers to talk about blended families. But when you also work in the next cubicle, the next office to a fan of the opposite rivalry, the next day someone's going to be unhappy and someone's going to be very happy. And, you know, but I'll tell you, the taunting is more in fun than anything else. There's more really nastiness that goes on between state in North Carolina because state feels like it's the redheaded stepchild. There's such a great respect between Duke and Carolina for what they've accomplished over the years. And I tell you, the other thing too is, when Carolina plays at Cameron, somehow, some way, 1,000 Carolina fans get into that building. And they don't say much during the game, but Carolina wins a lot over there. And when they win, in the last minute, when it's obvious that Carolina's going to win, you hear those 1,000 fans making as much noise as the other 8,000 when you're in the building. They sort of come out of their cocoons. And the Dean Dome, which is much bigger, I mean, it's the largest on-campus arena in the country. It's larger than any NBA arena except the Palace at Auburn Hills. So it's easier for Duke fans to get in, but a lot do get in, and same thing happens there. You know, with every basket Duke makes, there's a lot of cheering. It's very intense. The old cliche about being a wine and cheese crowd that Sam Cassell started over 20 years ago, Duke has never seen the wine and cheese crowd at the Smith Center, I promise you that. You know, you got 22,000 people who are standing and rocking for 40 minutes. And Jabari Parker, we talk about it in the book, Jabari Parker thought he was ready for that game last year after playing at Madison Square Garden twice. And then going to Syracuse, where Duke attracted the largest crowd in Terry Dome history last year, he thought, I'm prepared to go to the Smith Center. And after the game, when Carolina ran away from him in the second half, Johnny Moore, my co-author, interviewed Jabari after the game, and he was just sitting there shaking his head, and he said, I had no idea. I had no idea that a game like this could be any more intense than the ones we've already played. And now he knows. So there's something very special about that. And people all over the country always ask Johnny and I, what's it like? What are those games like? And you really can't describe it. You have to be there. I will tell you this. Duke is so small and so intimate. And the fans are so intense that when – you know how teams come out to warm up and then they go back in the locker room for the load spray, whatever, but they come out for the tip-off. When that happens, you never know what's going to happen after the ball goes up. It could be a close game. It could be not such a close game. But when they run out for the tip-off, it's the most electrifying moment that I've ever witnessed in sports. And I love it every single year when the teams both come out to start the game. The crowd's going crazy. Everybody has their eyes on the two coaches when they're going to meet. And it is really the height of anticipation in sports that I've never experienced anywhere else. And usually it's a great game. Sometimes it's not. But the anticipation is always off the charts.
All right. Well, fantastic, Art. Where's the best place we can purchase your book and learn more about you?
Well, it's in bookstores nationwide. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. It's available, I think, in most major Barnes & Noble's books. If they're not, you can just ask for it and they'll get it. But really, one of the easiest ways to do it is just go on Amazon and get it online. It's a great read. It's not written in a chronological order. It's written in 11 separate stories. So you can kind of take it to the bathroom and leave it there and, you know, read a story, read a chapter, put it down, and then go back and read another totally unrelated chapter. So it is really just a collection of great moments and inside stories on the greatest robbery in college basketball.
Fantastic, Art. Best of luck with the book, and go, I guess, the Tar Heels, even though my Panthers beat them in the tournament. We'll see what happens this year, Pitt in North Carolina. That'll be interesting.
That's great.
All right.
Thanks for your time, and take care of that voice.
I hope so. My voice is the golden voice, but not today. All right, good talking to you, Art. See you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, Toll Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Toll Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And my voice, after one interview, has gotten semi-warmed up after being sick for a week. But with the anniversary, five-year anniversary, let's keep the awesome interviews going on. So we want to welcome to the program Paul Gutierrez, author of 100 Things Raider Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And being a Bronco and Steeler fan, I just hope they die. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing well. And knowing now that you're a Bronco and a Steeler fan, and there's plenty of chapters in here that address the Raiders against the Broncos and the Steelers, too. So it's fun. It was a lot of fun to do this.
Well, I mean, thinking of the tradition of the Raiders, especially when the first Super Bowls and Al Davis, I mean, Jim Plunkett, Marcus Allen, I mean, the team with Lester Hayes. I mean, I could talk about on and on and on. You're like, you really know a lot about the Raiders. But they were a team you really wanted to hate. It weren't they? And that's what made them so special, I believe.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just being an NFL fan and knowing the history of the NFL, that's where teams like, you know, the Steel Curtain teams of the 70s, the Orange Crush teams of the 70s for the Broncos as well. If you want to be a fan of the NFL, then you should know the individual stories as well. And I think that's where the Raiders fit into this picture perfectly, is they're one of the organizations, especially back then, they were just part of the fabric of the NFL that goes back to the AFL, actually. And when you're talking about the team, I don't think there really was or is much middle ground. People, fans, either love them or they loathe them. And there's really no middle ground there. So in doing the book and in talking to a lot of the old school players and a lot of guys that are currently on the team right now, that feeling is still out there, that the Raiders, even though they've been on some rough skids here for more than a decade, they still look at themselves as such, that there are 31 NFL teams and then there are the Oakland Raiders. And take that for good, bad, indifferent, whatever, there's some truth to that as well. So it's definitely, they're a unique team that, you know, as you said, you just are rolling the names off, and they're legendary names, not only for this franchise, but for the NFL as well.
Well, definitely. Let's think about where I first got introduced to the Raiders. I mean, I knew him from the Steelers, but when I read a book on John Madden, his biography, that really gave me a little bit more of an idea to understand the Raiders, who they were, how disrespected they were in towns, and how John had to really get people to respect who the Raiders were. So at one point in time, the Raiders weren't this feared team, were they, back in the day?
No, and I think that all changed. They were one of the flagship franchises of the original AFL, which started play in 1960, but they didn't really become the Raiders that you know and recognize of today until Al Davis came in 1963 and basically rebranded them, remade them in his image. The Oakland Raiders originally, their colors were black and gold. It wasn't until
Al Davis, I didn't know that. Wow.
And he wanted to remake them in the image of what he grew up loving and fearing at the same time, the army teams, the Black Knights of the Hudson. Those are the color schemes that he wanted to use and brand and make that. And it's true. Even today, you think the color silver and black, I think you automatically think of the Raiders. I don't think you necessarily think of the Stanley Cup champion L.A. Kings.
No.
Borrowed the color scheme, or the Chicago White Sox, who did the same. But it's interesting. I don't think there's a team that really resonated or was so reflective of its owner than the Raiders. Maybe the Yankees under George Steinbrenner to a degree, but the Raiders under Al Davis, when you talk of one, you had to talk about the other because they were so intrinsically linked. So it all really began with the Raiders when Al Davis came. And he grew up in Brooklyn, and his two favorite teams growing up were the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees. He liked the power and the way that they could intimidate teams of the New York Yankees, but he also liked the speed and the forward-thinking progressiveness of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who signed Jackie Robinson. So those were the two ideals that he wanted to impart into a professional sports franchise. And then a lot of the bump-and-run coverage came from him watching John Wooden's UCLA basketball teams with their zone press. So he would take little bits and pieces of different sports, different teams that he liked, and he would try to impart them into his football team.
What made him so amazing in that way, Al, that he understood the game or understood what to do? A hands-on owner that was successful, right? That's not, you can't name a lot of them that are so hands-on that understand the game. And that's where Al,
starting
in the AFL days, for sure.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of coaches, even before his passing, still referred to Al Davis as coach. And you could make the case and probably win a lot of arguments saying that the game passed him by, that he needed more help in his later years, and that contributed to the downward spiral of the franchise towards the end. But at his heyday, I mean, for a coach to work for him, yeah, there was a lot of things that they had to deal with, but there was no middleman. There was no general manager. It was the head coach and Al Davis, and they worked hand in hand, and that's what John Madden talked about quite a bit. And when I talked to Tom Flores about it for this book, that's exactly what he talked about, was that later on in his life and in his career running the Raiders, he didn't have that right-hand man like he did with Madden, like he did with Flores, like he did with other guys down the stretch. So it was interesting, though, that he was a maverick. He was ahead of his time up until a certain point in time.
Most definitely. Let's go from that point, thinking about the Raiders, to my team I want to talk about because we have so little time today. It's the Stick'em team. It's the team that beat the Philadelphia Eagles. The reason I remember that team so well is, I guess, my age and how much of an NFL fan I was. But they were a wild card team. No one thought they had a shot, and they won the Super Bowl. And I'm sure that's definitely in the top 100 for sure, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Jim Plunkett, who was the MVP of that Super Bowl, the ultimate Lazarus tale, the Cinderella story, he wrote the foreword for me in the book. But just going through that season, there's a lot of interesting things that happened that year because Dan Pastorini was actually the starting quarterback on that team. If you recall, it was a starter-for-starter trade, Dan Pastorini for Ken Stabler, who went to the Houston Oilers. And it took 5 games into the season, and the team was struggling. Pastorini breaks his leg. Plunkett comes off the bench and basically saves the season. He hadn't played for about a year and a half, 2 years, and this is a guy who was a former number one overall pick 9 years earlier, Heisman Trophy winner out of Stanford, a Bay Area kid. And he just was able to take the team, which had talent, obviously, but had finished, predicted to finish last in the division that year, and went on a crazy run in the playoffs. They beat Ken Stabler himself in the first round of the wild card game. Then they go to Cleveland, and that's the Red Right 88 game where Brian Stipe tries to throw a touchdown instead of the Browns kicking a game-winning field goal. Then they win a shootout against the San Diego Chargers in San Diego, and then they beat up on the Philadelphia Eagles in New Orleans. And what I thought was interesting about that is Rod Martin had told me that the way that the Eagles were organized and run by Dick Vermeil at that time was very militaristic, that they were on curfews, they couldn't go out on Bourbon Street, they couldn't do anything. So the Raiders put it on themselves. They said, you know what, if we don't win this game, then the NFL being such a copycat league, every team is going to go to that militaristic approach. They weren't just playing for themselves, they were playing for the sanity of everybody else that still wanted some free time and to be able to do some things. So, you know, and one of the funny stories about that is John Matuszak breaking curfew consistently And Tom Flores told me as Matuszak's getting on the bus, he asked him, "Hey, what happened? I heard you broke curfew last night. You were out on Bourbon Street." He goes, "No, no, no, Coach. I wasn't breaking curfew. I was out making sure other guys weren't breaking curfew." So a lot of stories like that kind of float throughout the book.
I mean, they're characters. The players that you look at, the Raider great teams, are characters that are interesting. I could talk about ones in the list because I know we're running out of time, but think about it. I know that definitely the one about the Sound of Music story, I'm sure that's in the book. I'm sure that's one of the top 100. And I'm also,
You mean
the comeback?
The Heidi game?
Yeah.
The Heidi game is definitely in there. Things like that are in there.
The Immaculate Reception, I'm sure, is in there too, right?
The Reception's in there. The Tuck Rule is in there. And one that the Bronco fan and you might not appreciate, but I know a lot of Raider fans did, was the Rob Lytle fumble, non-fumble in that 1977 AFC title game. So, we hit on a lot of different things throughout, and I'm really proud that I was able to talk to a lot of different players from back then. And, you know, the fanboy in me got to talk to Carl Weathers. You know, Apollo Creed played for the Raiders for 2 years in the early 70s. So I'm talking to him. I'm thinking, wow, I'm talking to the Count of Monte Cristo, the King of Sting, Apollo Creed, the heavyweight champ. And he tells me, you know, after he left the Raiders, he wasn't a very good football player, he said. But Al Davis always referred to him as champ.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
It's pretty interesting to talk to.
How those opportunities come. So where's the best place, Paul, we can purchase your book and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Yeah, well, it's Triumph Books. So triumphbooks.com, it'll be right there. It's part of a series of 100 things. But you do a look on any Amazon or Barnes & Noble and your local bookstore, I'm sure you can walk in and order it. 100 Things Raider Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's a great, in my opinion, anyway, a great holiday gift for your loved ones.
Absolutely. Well, best of luck. I could talk to you for hours about the Raiders. Maybe they'll get back into but we know the NFL, a couple years, and then they'll have a team again. It's just how it works.
We'll see.
Okay. All right. Good talking to you. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, Toll Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Toll Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I love talking college basketball, so I'm excited to welcome to the program Anthony Gimeno, author of 100 Things Arizona Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Anthony, thanks for calling. And you know what? I love these 100 things for sure. They're interesting to talk about with all the history for sure.
They are, you know, for as much fun as it may be to read, they're probably even more fun to write because you get to talk to so many people and kind of unearth so many stories that have either been forgotten or people are telling for the first time because they're in a good mood to be open about what's happened in the past. And for this book, for the Arizona book, you know, we had a lot of help from Lute Olson, which was fantastic. And when it was done and he got his copy and he read through it, I think the best compliment we could have possibly gotten was that Lute was like, you know, there's stories in here I didn't even know. So if we were able to surprise Lute with a couple things, that I think we unearthed a couple of really some fun anecdotes to go with the history of Arizona basketball, which, you know, actually – most people just know Lute, but there's actually a pretty good history before Lute even arrived.
That's what I'm interested in talking about because I wouldn't have thought that. I mean, when you think of Pac-10 basketball, whatever it was called, before all the big conferences, before the big TV deals and stuff like that, UCLA controlled the West pretty much, right? They owned the West.
Right.
So did Arizona have teams that can compete against UCLA at one point in time, if you're talking that time of Wooden and stuff?
You know, in the 1970s, when Arizona was in the WAC, they were part of some really high-scoring, fun teams that made a couple runs in the NCAA tournament. And part of that was with the coach, Fred Snowden, who, historically speaking, was the first African-American head basketball coach in the country. In those teams, he had what's called in the early 70s the Kitty Corps, and he brought in a bunch of guys from the Detroit, Michigan area. Connell Norman was one of those guys, just guys who could light it up, guys who ended up going on to the NBA, Eric Money. So the years in the 70s, before Arizona joined the Pac-10 in 1978, were or something of a lost time in Arizona basketball history because of the emphasis on what's happened from Lute Olson and beyond. But they were really good basketball times. And you go back to the 50s, and again, a very competitive time. Arizona had a 81-82 game home winning streak at Old Bear Down Gym, which is still in the top 10. I believe it's in, probably in the top five nationally, all-time home winning streaks. And so you go back even then, and you see some pretty interesting history, including a guy named Mo Udall, who everybody knows as a longtime U.S. congressman. He was one of those stars on the teams in the 1950s. Uh-huh. And he had one eye, which is an amazing story. He had just one working eye.
Do you think in college basketball at that time, if we're talking about history of Arizona basketball till the 80s, when really we know with Lute Olson, that's when the program really came on the map, even though they were winning teams, the way college basketball was and how it was not many teams and it was very regionalized in specific ways, you really didn't have the chance to compete for national championships like you do today, right? Am I correct about that with the years? Did they ever win the national title in those early years?
Well, no, they did not. I mean, the only title they won was 97. And then when Lute came here in 83, 84, he inherited a team that had won four games the previous year. It was a one-year coaching disaster. And the thing that really hastened Lute's prospects, you talk about being regionalized and stuff like that, the thing that really made Lute successful so quickly here was that he had a kid named Sean Elliott in his backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Elliott was a Tucson kid. He really, really wasn't going to go anywhere else. And Arizona did a great job of recruiting Sean and recruiting Sean's mom. And Sean Elliott comes to Tucson to be part of the very early Lute Olson teams. And by his junior year, Arizona's playing in the 1988 Final Four. You know, and really the 89 team the year after may have been even better, but that's the year they were upset by a UNLV team that ended up becoming somewhat of the UNLV team we know of the early 1990s and that great kind of run that the Rebels had. So, yeah, Lute was able to draw, again, getting, frankly, a little bit lucky, having Sean Elliott here. And then once he got rolling, Lute could recruit and get kids from any part of the country, get a Khalid Reeves out of New York, and obviously do very, very well in California.
And so and before that, it was like very difficult before Lute came in to recruit competing against UCLA. For sure, if you look at the years of UCLA and their dominance. And then
And for Arizona, the problem was, we talked a little bit about Fred Snowden, and by the time Arizona got to the Pac-10 in 1978, and with Arizona's budget, he really wasn't able to go out and get those kids from other parts of the country. You know, like he built his early success on parts of the country he knew, which was Detroit and then some of the stuff in the Midwest. And by the end of his tenure, he wasn't able to go out across the country and compete nationally for recruits, and part of that was just his budget. So by the late or by the early 80s, the program was in decline, and then they hired a guy named Ben Lindsay as the head coach, which, as I mentioned, was an absolute disaster. And then Cedric Dempsey, who was the athletic director at the time, was able to approach Lute Olson coming off a regional final appearance and say, hey, let's sit down and talk. And Lute thought it was the right time, because what he had built at Iowa was becoming so big, he really felt like he was in the fishbowl at Iowa. So he somewhat exchanged that fishbowl for what would later become somewhat of a fishbowl in Tucson, but then he ends up staying for a quarter of a century.
So by recruiting Sean Elliott, it changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
It changed everything because you have a player who's one of the best in the country, and people wanted to play around him. And they saw in the exposure in the West, and there was just the perfect time, for sure.
It really quickened the process, no doubt. I mean, I think Lute would have been successful here eventually anyways, but would it have happened so quickly, winning Pac-10 titles in his first, you know, within the span of a few years? Probably not. And the other key factor was that, was one of his early recruiting trips was kind of an open gym in Southern California. He and his wife, Bobby, were there, and they happened to see this kind of skinny white guard. And Lute really liked him. Turns out it was Steve Kerr, who didn't really have any offers at the time. And if anybody knows the history of Arizona, they know how important Bobby Olson, which is Lute's late wife, was to the process, to the recruiting process. And Lute was talking to, they were leaving the gym, and Lute was saying to Bobby, I really like that Steve Kerr kid. I want to work him out tomorrow again, learn more about him. And Lute asked, what do you think of him? And Bobby turned to him and goes, I don't think he can play for Arizona. And it was like, that was like the only time she was ever wrong about a kid. She was like way down on Steve Kerr. And Steve Kerr never let Bobby forget about that either. But it did. Luke came back, got another open gym with Steve Kerr. And at the time, he didn't even have any he didn't have any official visits to offer. He had used all his official visits. But he convinced Steve that, you know, this was a great offer. And it was the best offer Steve Kerr had. And so Steve Kerr jumped on it, and I guess we can say the rest of that is also history. So those Kerr Elliott teams were a great combination. And then you had guys like Tom Tolbert, who's gone on to be so prominent in radio, kind of a little bit of a knucklehead, but a lovable knucklehead. Anthony Cook, who was kind of underrated, skinny power forward. Craig McMillan, who's coaching junior college now up in Northern California. So it was, those are really good teams. And still, frankly, they probably rank on the very short list of best Arizona teams ever, you know, in the top two or three of those late 80 teams.
Well, I'm, again, being an East Coast guy and a Big East guy, and I had really good conversations with some Big East people, the authors. It's like, thinking about this, I know about who were the stars of Arizona, but I did not. What it seems like to me, Anthony, is they didn't have a lot of superstars. So Lute really was able to get a lot out of the talent he had, it sounds like. I mean, they were great players, but however, not tons of household names.
Maybe. I mean, in the early years, I think that was true. By the early 90s, like when he was getting the Khalid Reeves, a guy like Brian Williams, who transferred from Maryland, Chris Mills, who transferred from Kentucky. Okay. Those were certainly cream of the crop. And then you follow up with later in your career with the Andre Iguodalas and the Chase Buttingers, and you know, towards the very end of his career. So he was able to. I think Lute kind of married the best of both worlds, where he got highly recruited athletic guys, and also develop them. You know, I think some teams kind of recruit just on a fantasy team kind of level. Like, oh, this kid's rated number 40. We want to get him without any idea of how they fit into the team.
Like Kentucky.
And Lute had that ability to put the puzzle pieces together with some guys who are a little bit under the radar or role players with the elite athletes. And honestly, I think Sean Miller now is almost taking that to a whole nother level.
Oh yeah.
Sean may be in a way the best I've seen, at least on the West Coast, of getting your top 10, top 15, top 20 recruits, but bringing all that together with a plan. And his roster construction is really impressive to me, where he gets those guys who are going to be around 3 or 4 years, with the one-and-done guys, with an experienced transfer or two who can fill in, like a T.J. McConnell, a point guard right now, just to put that all together and have yourself a team rather than just a collection of 10 or 12 highly rated guys.
Quite interesting. And so with Lute, what made him a successful coach, especially winning a national championship? What made him a successful coach, winning so many games with Arizona? What do you think it was? What made him different than other coaches, in your opinion?
The guys from those years, I think, will probably tell you two things. One is his attention to detail. They talk about their practices, and I guess a lot of coaches do this, but maybe he was one of the first. Just the attention to detail, the beginning of practice, almost all of practice was like fundamental work. It's fundamental work, fundamental work. And then in the last 15, 20 minutes of practice, whatever, throw the ball out and say, go at it. So it was a little bit of attention to detail, and everything was down to the second. You know, there were no surprises. So the consistency was certainly one thing. And two, in the early 1990s, with the teams that had the Khalid Reeves, Damon Stoudemire, Reggie Geary, Lute was really the first guy. He's kind of the guy who's credited with using to its best effect a three-guard lineup. You know, in the early 90s here at Arizona, they had what they called the Tucson Skyline. Sean Rooks, Ed Stokes, you know, but basically a bunch of seven-footers.
Right.
After they left, Lute went small. You know, the 93, 94 teams and then beyond often played that three-guard lineup that would just hound you defensively, could shoot the three, get out on the break, and just run you and transition you to death. And that really, all that really started with Lute. So what we see, you know, we talk about the tournament, NCAA tournament being a tournament for the guards, a guard-dominated tournament. That really started with Ludolf. So I think he usually gets the bulk of the credit nationally for being that guy to use it the best.
How important is academics for Lute when he was coaching in Arizona and seeing his athletes be student athletes? This is a question because you again covered them and understand what was about that made Lute. Because again, we know stories of Lute Olson, especially with the challenges he faced in his life later on during his career as a coach. But what about with his players and stuff like
that? I think you can see some of the life skills from players of that era, just whether they got that from Arizona academically or just from the family atmosphere that's often talked about among those teams, just with the success so many basketball players have had beyond basketball. You see, we talked recently to Bennett Davison, who was a forward on that 1997 championship team, and Bennett was. He was one of those guys who was a little bit of a goofball, again, kind of a lovable knucklehead. And now he's involved in a project that helps basketball players assimilate to life overseas if you're playing in Europe. They, in terms of how to approach it financially, socially, culturally, and just talking to him about his new project, it's like, and we're like, this isn't the guy who once rode a baggage carousel in the Eugene airport, you know, this is a different guy. So he's one of those success stories. You look at a guy like Harvey Mason, who's a Grammy award winning music producer and artist. He was on those early 90 teams. Just, you know, there's Matt Muehlbach, who was the first guy in Arizona history to have a triple-double. He's now in announcing. He's a lawyer in Tucson. It just seems like there's so many success stories among those players. Again, beyond basketball, you can look at the Steve Kerrs, who's now coaching in the NBA, or guys like that. But just there's just so many of those guys who have gone on to do great things beyond the court.
So it seems like he was a very good father figure for them at the university and really being there for them in this family atmosphere.
The one thing Matt Muehlbach had mentioned in doing the book when talking about Lute, it's like you talk about father figure, and Lute, and Matt was like, you know, Lute was like that grandfather you didn't want to disappoint, you know? There was just something about him. He had a very commanding, and still does, a very commanding presence about him. And he wasn't necessarily, he wasn't the touchy-feely, let's have some Dr. Phil moments in my office kind of guy.
Yeah.
But he was, and some of that was left to his assistants. So, again, that was kind of balance on the coaching staff. But, yeah, Lute was just that father figure, grandfather figure. Yeah, you just didn't want to let him down. So, and that's how the players, when they were playing for him, responded to him. And then after their career, they got to see a little bit more of the kind of the softer side of Lute, I guess you could say. But he was, as a coach, he was very stoic. You know, he wasn't like he wasn't warm and cuddly. He wasn't necessarily a big jerk either. He famously never swore. Andre Iguodala once nearly got him to swear, but.